Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Bloomberg Business Week weekend podcast. This week, a key U.S. price gauge topped forecast for a third straight month on gains in rents and transportation costs, fanning fears it will stick and delay Fed interest rate cuts. We've really rolled back our expectations when it comes to Fed moves this year. This hour, though, on transportation, we've got David Neeleman. He's the founder of five commercial airlines, including JetBlue and Breeze. He stops by to talk pricing and more. We also take a look at Delta's results and the revival of business travel.
Also ahead, speaking of the sky.
Yeah. Yes.
The eclipse. Did you see it, Carol?
I did, courtesy of the NASA live stream.
Okay. Well, the live stream was pretty cool. I actually got to venture outside, as did millions of Americans. Some 30 million people live in the path of totality. That's according to NASA. And lots more got to check it out. We had people traveling from all over to the path of totality to check out the eclipse. Maybe you'll be able to view the next eclipse, though, from way up in the sky.
Very cool.
On a space balloon. How does that sound?
Even cooler.
Okay. We're going to explain how you can do that with the co-founder and co-CEO of Space Perspective, Jane Poynter.
Sign me up. Plus, the top 10 global stocks to watch and a double dose of golf, the putter used by Tiger Woods and others that's turned a brand into an asset class, and the on-again, off-again, on-again drama of the PGA Tour and LIV Golf.
All of that to come. We begin with Boeing, though. Some news this week. The company facing a deepening crisis of confidence after deliveries in the first quarter dipped to the lowest since mid-2021. Also, a longtime Boeing engineer alleged that the company took manufacturing shortcuts on its 787 Dreamliner aircraft.
Yeah, the woes continue for Boeing. And this also as a reminder of how far the plane maker has to go on its road to recovery from a near catastrophic accident early in January. No doubt major airlines are watching for what comes next from Boeing, which brings us to an individual well known in the commercial aviation industry, David Neeleman.
David is the founder and CEO of Breeze Airways. He's also a disruptor in the space, having founded five airlines, including JetBlue, WestJet, and now Breeze Airways. We got his take on Boeing, how summer demand is shaping up, and the growth of his newest company.
We actually made our first profit. We made a profit in March, and we expect to be profitable for the year. And, you know, this is in a year where, you know, some of the ULCCs are really struggling, and you know, I'm just really proud of our team. We've really carved out a really great niche where people love flying on Breeze. They love the airplanes, the service. We have almost 200 routes, and 90% of them we have no nonstop competition, but they're routes that people really love to fly. And so that's really, you know, the most important thing for us is profitability and continuing to grow and continuing to find great new markets and maturing the markets that we have today.
So talk to us a little bit about fares holding up in this class. I mean, it feels like there are a lot of budget seats in the market. I mean, talk to us a little bit about fares and pricing and summer demand, how you're starting to see that shape up.
Well, it's good. I mean, we had a good first quarter. You know, it was interesting. We did more revenue in March than we did the whole first quarter of last year. Kind of shows you our growth. April looks good. You know, May is May. It's a bit of a transition month where we move a lot of our north-south flying to east-west. So, you know, May looks pretty good. And then June, summer looks strong and, you know, holding our projections for a profitable year. So, you know, it's interesting because we have kind of a base fare that's, you know, kind of like a basic economy like everybody else has. And then the jump ups where you go from the nicer to nicest, where you get into a first class seat, isn't that bad. And people love it.
Hey, David, I'm interested in the fleet, Airbus A220s, Embraer 190s and 195s. How are you able to survive with such a small airplane when it seems like everybody else is increasing the size of the planes that they're using to offset those higher pilot salaries?
That's a great question. It's a really great question. So, The Embraers we use primarily for charters. We do have a little bit of scheduled service with them, and they're going away by the end of this year, and it'll be all 220s. The 190s, in the month of March, we did almost 600 charters that we flew, you know, for NCAA, March Madness, and all of that. So we use those planes primarily for that operation, and our pilots and flight crews do a great job. Now, the 220, you're right. I mean, pilot salaries have gone up, and you know, fortunately, the pilot shortage situation in the U.S. has really gotten better, much better. You know, with pilots getting ready to be laid off at some airlines, and a lot of airlines not hiring, and a lot of that's because of Boeing deliveries. But because the 220 is so efficient on fuel burn and maintenance costs, you know, we only have 137 seats, and our trip cost, we believe, is about 20% lower, 15 to 20% lower than a 320. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our competitors fly A320s, you know, be it Spirit or Frontier or Allegiant or JetBlue. Mm-hmm. So we can fly for 20% lower, and that just opens up an exponential amount of routes that we can fly because we have lower trip costs. Because the plane is new and it's efficient and, you know, has these long ranges, so we can do these long, thin routes as well. So, you know, yeah, I mean, what Spirit's, I think, is really struggling trying to figure out, what do I do with a 240-seat airplane? Right. I got to fly where everybody else is. And, you know, the other, everybody else is not, you know, being kind of late to them, where 80% of their routes, they have nonstop competition. 90% of our routes, we have no nonstop competition.
You know, David, you've used Airbus planes a lot in your timeline and creation of five different carriers, if you will. And you had the Airbus 320s, right? A big part of JetBlue back then. I'm just curious what you make of what's going on with Boeing in trouble again, if you will. And, you know, it's a duopoly, right? It's either Airbus or Boeing at this point. But I'm just curious how you were thinking about Boeing and its future here. And why don't you choose more Boeings?
My first airline, Morris Air, had Boeings. And I love Boeing. And I, you know, went up to Boeing and was fully intent on buying 737s for JetBlue. We couldn't come to an agreement, so I went and met with Airbus. Airbus just sold me that they had a better product, a better airplane, a better, our customers would love it more, you know, fly-by-wire, just so many other advantages, better fuel burn. And it was just a newer technology. It was a newer technology airplane. So I picked Airbus at that time. Now, the reason I picked it wasn't because of safety. It was just because it was a better airplane for us and it was a better airplane for our customers. I fly 737s on a weekly basis. I just got off a United 737 last week. I feel 100% safe. I have total confidence in Boeing. Obviously, they're going through a rough patch here, you know, but the safety record in the United States for all commercial carriers is unbelievable. I mean, if you look back, it's hard to find the last major accident by a Boeing airplane, you know, in the United States. And it's really difficult. So I my heart goes out to Boeing. I know they're going through it. I know this will make them a better company. And I expect them to come out of it stronger than ever.
That was the founder and CEO of Breeze Airways, David Neeleman.
And while we're talking about airlines, Delta this week gave an earnings outlook that topped Wall Street estimates thanks to a step up in corporate travel and steady leisure demand heading into summer. The stock came under, though, some pressure following those results, as did the overall airlines group following U.S. inflation data that showed airfares dropped 7.1% in March from the prior year. That, Tim, was the biggest decrease since November.
Bottom line, we wanted to hear more about Delta. And so we checked in with Bloomberg News U.S. Airlines reporter Mary Schlangenstein.
What Delta talked about primarily was, one, that their operations, their flight operations, have really improved this year. And they're not alone in doing that. There hasn't been a lot of bad weather, and a lot of the airlines are performing better operationally. But they're also talking about a big factor being the return of some of the corporate travel accounts that were lagging, the areas that were lagging, like tech and financial services. They're finally seeing those companies come back, so that managed corporate travel revenue is back to 2019 levels. Wow. Volumes are still lagging, but the revenue has returned to 2019.
Remind us, Mary, about where Delta gets its revenue mix in terms of domestic versus international here.
Yeah, they're still more heavily domestic, but the differentiator for Delta is so much of their revenue comes from premium products. So in the first quarter, Their premium product revenue rose 10%. Main cabin only rose 4%. And that's been a pretty consistent thing for them. They really focus on that premium customer. And their sales, you know, have been leaning more toward that area for some time.
But since they're more heavily domestic, how much were they affected by a slowdown in potential slowdown in domestic travel and an increase of late in international travel?
So international travel has been really strong since last year, and Delta's saying it continues to be really strong. Even across the Atlantic, where there were concerns early on that there was too much capacity in that market this year, but Delta says there's plenty of demand. They see demand strong to the Pacific and Latin America. Domestically, they're saying demand's picked up too. They're picking up some travel, they think, from the domestic focus carriers that are having to rejuggle their schedules and redo their operating schedule because of some conditions specific to the domestic market.
You're talking about Boeing or Spirit JetBlue?
No, we're talking about domestic focus carriers like Spirit, Allegiant, even JetBlue to some extent.
Okay.
Hey, Mary, one thing I wanted to ask you, the CEO, Ed Bastian, saying in your story that you noted is that while revenue acceleration has brought the carrier back fully to 2019 levels, you just said that earlier, volume remains 85 to 90% of pre-pandemic levels. Does that mean, so yay, Delta has more of a runway to kind of grow that and grow the revenue line? Or is it, how is the industry rethinking about the levels that were pre-pandemic and where we are? Do we go back to those levels at some point?
Well, on business travel in particular, I think that they believe that there's some segment of that volume that's just not going to come back because they're still seeing, a permanency to some of the changed travel patterns where people are taking, to blend leisure travel and business travel. So their business trip may be longer. They maybe aren't traveling as frequently as they did before. So I think part of the volume is always going to be gone. I think the revenue, even on non-business travel, has exceeded 2019 levels already, and so has the volume for leisure travel.
Mary, my head is on the equipment providers, Airbus, Boeing, Embraer, Bombardier, all of which provide aircraft to Delta. I'm wondering, since it does have a mixed fleet, was there any commentary about Boeing on the call?
Not a lot. Delta does primarily fly Boeing aircraft. They don't currently fly the MAX. They have the MAX 10 on order, but they don't expect to receive that for about 3 years yet. But what CEO Ed Bastian did say was that, safety is a top priority across the industry, and that every day, that's the top priority for every airline. So he didn't comment specifically on Boeing, and he didn't comment specifically on the safety incidents that have been occurring across the industry recently, but just said that's a top priority. He did say in an interview I had with him yesterday that he knows the new chairman at Boeing is familiar with him, and he expects that at some point he will talk to him about any concerns about Boeing itself.
Has there been any chatter about them changing their order of those new MAX planes that have not yet been delivered to Airbus, if that isn't even a possibility, given the Airbus supply constraints?
They just placed that order recently. They haven't had it for very long. And I don't think there's any consideration at this point. The deliveries are due farther out. That gives plenty of time for the MAX 10 to be certified before their deliveries come up, and even for Boeing to catch up on some production. So I don't think that's being considered right now.
That's Bloomberg News U.S. Airlines reporter Mary Schlangenstein.
Coming up, sure, you could get on a plane, but how about floating up into Earth's upper atmosphere at a cool 12 miles per hour via a ship-launched balloon? What do you think?
Maybe a nice little glass of champagne to go along with it. Well, the co-founder and co-CEO of Space Perspective coming up next. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
This past Monday, millions across North America took a break from whatever they were doing to stare up at the sky and take in person, possibly a once-in-a-lifetime cosmic wonder. A total solar eclipse. And Tim, you even left the studio to give us a live report while it was happening. I mean, I got to say, you were giddy kind of leading up into it.
Yeah, I was pretty excited. I mean, I have memories from when I was a little kid, probably 5 or 6 years old, checking out the eclipse at summer camp.
Remember those boxes?
Yeah.
Like we used to make, right, with the holes and like, I don't know.
Yeah, the pinhole projectors, right? Unfortunately, New York City was overcome by a massive cloud during most of the eclipse. However, it still was pretty cool.
All right, even rarer, but hoping to become more common, is floating up into Earth's upper atmosphere. atmosphere at a cool 12 miles per hour. It all happens on a ship-launched balloon in a 16-foot spherical capsule up to 100,000 feet. I mean, Tim, forget about watching, like we said, the next eclipse from New York. How about taking a tour to space itself?
Yeah, okay. It could potentially become a reality. It's going to cost you, though, $125,000. Hmm. After 3 hours, though, you'll be able to look out the windows and see something very few people have been able to see. Large portions of land and sea, the rimmed curvature of the Earth, and of course, millions of stars. That's all part of the experience Space Perspective is looking to provide. So for more on this, we checked in with the co-founder and co-CEO of Space Perspective, Jane Poynter.
We are wanting to take as many people as possible to space. Only 650 people have ever been to space in the entire history of humanity, which is kind of crazy to think about.
And that includes people like Jeff Bezos, who've gone via Blue Origin.
Or Neil Armstrong?
Yeah.
Or Neil Armstrong?
Yeah,
people who walk
on
the moon.
That includes everybody.
Yeah.
So everybody.
Do you consider
a tiny number of people.
Do you consider 100,000 feet above Earth space?
Oh, yeah, actually. So, I mean, look, it's an interesting question. There really is no universal definition of space, actually. And we, as you said, we are above 99% of the atmosphere. That last 1% stretches way past the International Space Station. So in essence, it's a space environment. It's a vacuum outside the enormous windows we fly to space. And then we're also regulated by the FAA's Office of Commercial Space Transportation as a spacecraft. Hmm. So yeah, we're definitely in space. Well, you could say we're at the edge of space.
But what would you say to critics who say, okay, we actually think, and like, again, there's no universal definition of it, but critics might say, okay, we think it's 100 kilometers above Earth. We think it's 330,000 feet, 62 miles.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's a little arbitrary. And the most important thing is that what our customers are getting is access to that quintessential astronaut experience of seeing Earth from space. I mean, that is what's important. And that's what we're offering. And we're offering it in a way that is really accessible, right? I mean, when most people think about spaceflight, they think about rockets. They think about the high G forces that some describe as like having an elephant sitting on your chest, or the constricting spacesuits, the training, the uncomfortable capsule. I mean, let's face it, it may be thrilling for those who want that kind of thing, but it is not very comfortable. You're not going to take your family or your grandma on a rocket to space for the most part. However, what we are doing at Space Perspective is a very different kind of experience whereby it truly is something that you can take your family on. It's a family-friendly version of going to space because it's so gentle. And then you get that outrageous view of seeing our Earth.
Help me out here. We're looking at your website. So tell me, I'm seeing this white, it looks like a balloon. I mean, tell me how it all works. Yep. And are these actually up in space yet and tested, or give me an idea?
Yeah, so yes, what you're seeing there is a space balloon at the top, and then beneath it is a pressurized capsule. So if you can get on a commercial airplane, then you can get on Spaceship Neptune. That is the idea of the design. And indeed, many of these space balloons have been flown before. You know, most people have never heard of them, but they've actually been flown over 1,000 times by NASA, European Space Agency, by some of our team members as well. And in the last 20 years, there have been no incidents in space. So it's this legacy technology, this what's technically called a zero pressure balloon that we're using. And actually, my co-founder and I have taken people higher than we're going. We've carried capsules larger and heavier than Spaceship Neptune. So we've really done every aspect of this before. And we did an initial test flight a couple of years ago. And now we're getting into a full-on series of uncrewed test flights with our test capsule, Excelsior, that is exactly the same as the one that we're all going to be flying to space on.
How does it get into space? What's the propulsion?
Oh, it's buoyancy control. Huh. So there's a gas inside the balloon that is lighter than the air around it.
Right.
And it literally lifts it up off the, you mentioned earlier that we do launch from a ship. So it lifts it up. And then once you're in space and, you know, we've hung out and hung at our bar and had your meal or whatever it is you're going to do in space, your wedding, played your music, we let out a little bit of gas, which then brings it very gently back down to the ocean for a splashdown. So it's exactly the same as like For example, you know, some people ask me, doesn't it just keep on, why doesn't it keep on going out to space?
Right.
Think of it like an ice cube floating on top of water. The space balloon is literally floating on top of the atmosphere.
So, Jane, one interesting thing about this is that you launch from a ship.
Yeah.
Why choose to launch from a ship in the ocean rather than from dry land?
Yeah. It was a game-changing decision for the company, actually. So you would think, surely it's easier, less complicated to launch from the land. Well, I mean, yes, I suppose. But the issue is, just like a rocket launch, there are weather sensitivities. So what the ship does for us, it does many things. We can move the ship with the wind and the direction of the wind, so we can create almost perfect launch conditions over the ship in really broad operating envelope. We can then move the ship to areas of good weather throughout the year. So now we've got reliable weather windows all year long. And we have this incredibly scalable operation because we can move it all over the world. We can also duplicate it very readily. And then we can do these spaceflight operations. We're going to initially start operating from the Florida region all the way around the peninsula in the Caribbean. And then we're going to have these same kinds of operations all over the world. So it is just completely enabling for the company.
And you're up actually in, I don't know, do I say orbit, or you're up for about 6 hours or so? That's kind of your average trip?
Yeah, so think of it as a suborbital flight. And so our initial flights are 6 hours. So it takes about 2 hours to go up. You're up there roughly 2 hours and then 2 hours to come back down. And of course, we do have thoughts of, wouldn't it be awesome to do an overnight in space or even a couple of nights in space? And we can do that with the current technology without really pushing the tech much at all.
I have a question, though. Everything that's on the website, is that actual things that have happened or is that visualizations?
So there's a bit of both.
Okay.
So there's a bunch of renders, right? So the way we visualize it for people is to show the renderings of the entire flight. However, last week we did actually unveil the completed capsule, and it looks so like the render that I actually have to tell people it is not a rendering. It is the real thing. We're going to be, sorry, go ahead.
Well, we have a minute left, then we're going to do some news, and then we're going to come back for some more. But just give us an update on the timeline when you actually expect to fly people for the first time.
Right, so we're going to be getting into uncrewed test flights just in a few weeks. We're going to do roughly 10 of those, assuming we get through all the safety gates, and then we'll be getting into human test flights, crewed test flights, around Q3, Q4 this year.
Okay.
And then getting into commercial flights around the end of the year, early next.
Well, it's kind of fascinating to hear this. I want to ask you a little bit about your history. You've been in this world and doing interesting things for some time, but I want to take you back to, you were actually involved with Worldview, right? A former CEO. So another company in the space that is using balloons to shoot people high above the atmosphere, if you will. In December of 2017, they actually had a hydrogen-filled balloon that exploded at one of their facilities. And so I'm just curious, and I know things have been looked into and so on and so forth, but I guess the use of hydrogen, which you guys are using, correct, today,
yes.
What are the risks in what you are doing? Nothing is ever risk-free.
So let me say several things. That accident, or I guess the incident, let's call it that, that occurred with that balloon was it was being used in a way that would not normally being used. And I don't want to take the time to go into all the technical details, but there was a lot of work done to really understand what happened there. And it's not anything that would be able to happen in the future because we're just not using the balloon in that way in the future. And of course, everybody thinks of the Hindenburg. I mean, let's just talk about the real tragedy in the elephant in the room, right? Well, the Hindenburg was 85 years ago, and it was an airship that was designed for helium, not for hydrogen. And that is really important because hydrogen is only flammable if it is in the presence of oxygen. And the way that that particular airship was designed, the way all the airships are typically designed, is you have a ballonet in the center of the airship that's filled with the gas. In this case, it was hydrogen. And then you have an air gap And then you have the outer skin. Well, the air gap, everything tends to leak, particularly then because it wasn't designed for hydrogen, mm-hmm. leaked hydrogen into that air gap. So now you've got this incredibly flammable mixture of hydrogen and air trapped inside this airship. Then the skin of the airship was painted in a daub that, frankly, was a fire starter. So when it was ignited by a spark from the pole that it was sitting on, that ignited the skin, which then ignited the flammable gas. Okay, so that obviously would never happen if it was actually designed for hydrogen. So now let's talk about how they are designed. So since the 1700s, balloons have been used, thousands of balloons have been used since the 1700s mm-hmm. all over the world. And there isn't a single recorded incident of an accident attributed to the hydrogen. And that's simply because the hydrogen is inside the balloon. And if there is any leakage, it just goes out the top and goes straight up. There's nowhere for it to go that can get trapped. And so, you know, for us, it's a very, if you know how to handle it, and people all over the world use it, it's a very safe way to go. It's actually a better lift gas than helium, which is in such, that's the other lift gas. And that is in such short supply now that even NOAA uses hydrogen in all of their weather balloons now.
That was Jane Poynter, the co-founder and co-CEO of Space Perspective.
All right, back down to Earth we go, and the realities, for better or for worse, of the 10 stocks to watch. It's all coming up. This is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, Tim. So what happens when our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts sort through the barrel to find the good apples across sectors and regions, a group of companies that come from a larger group of high confidence focus ideas that BI identifies on an ongoing basis? Do you know what happens?
I know what happens because, I prepared for the segment.
You did.
But what they do is they come up with, at least this time around, the 10 companies to watch in the second quarter. This story featured in the new issue of Business Week magazine. It's available on newsstands on the Bloomberg terminal and at Bloomberg.com/business.
All right, so let's get more on those 10 companies. Back with us, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior European Strategist and Director of Research Content, Tim Craighead. He is joining us from London. Tim, we always love going through these lists with you. So take it away. We kind of set it up. Is there anything we need, anything else we need to know as how you guys curated this list?
Thanks for having me on. And I would say that one of the things that happens when we come up and do these sort of things is that the Business Week folks come up with some really cool graphics in the magazine. And in particular, if you look at it on the online version. But suffice to say, from Bloomberg Intelligence's perspective, this list of 10, you referred to it, is part of a broader list of what we call focus ideas. And the focus ideas are companies where we've got a very strong fundamental view, a high conviction view, that we think is differentiated from the market and what the market seems to be discounting, you know, as it relates to the stocks and whatnot. And importantly, there's a catalyst ahead that we think can change the market's point of view, assuming we're correct. And importantly, with these 10 companies that we focused on here, they all have really key catalysts coming up for the second quarter. And that's why we've picked these. There's two of them that are cautious views. There's eight of them that are positive views. They span sectors, they span regions. And yeah, that's the setup.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those sectors. I want to start with tech and innovation, because a couple, and these are not, I would argue that not every one of these companies on here is a household name, and certainly some of them are on the smaller side. So talk about what you found in tech and innovation and what the team found there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's an awful lot going on in the world of technology these days about AI. You can't not talk about it. And there's two companies here that we've got on the list that are related to artificial intelligence. One is Salesforce, which is the world's largest infrastructure software company. And notwithstanding how big this company is, it still actually may not be a household name, given the nature of the beast. Importantly, any company that is looking at all the information they get from their customers probably relies on Salesforce and their software programs. And they're going through two things right now. One is a big tech infrastructure software spending cycle that we think is gaining momentum. And then secondly, it's the need for information to feed AI programs and initiatives. And Salesforce is right smack in the middle of all of this. The other one is a company called Tencent. And if you're in China, you definitely know about Tencent. It has a lot of things going on within the world of online gaming. Importantly, from our perspective, they've gotten into short videos, and AI is enhancing the way that they're generating revenue from advertising. Both of those are feeding Tencent's business that we think is underappreciated by the market. The last one I would mention is a company not in the world of classic tech, but technology in the world of medicine, a company called Penumbra.
The one I was thinking of when I say not a household name.
Exactly. So these guys make computer-assisted vacuum technology products. And you say, what is that? Think blood clots. And usually the way you treat blood clots is with anticoagulant drugs. And they've got all sorts of other ramifications. Penumbra's computer-assisted vacuum technology can go in and actually suck blood clots out of arteries and veins, even really small ones, and you don't have to take the drugs. It's great. And again, all three of these we think could generate better than anticipated revenue, margins, earnings.
And I just want to mention, when you talked about Salesforce, we actually spoke with Alice Steinglass, Executive VP, General Manager over at Salesforce, and they talked about the role of Gen AI and the role of data and making it ready for their customers. So she kind of got into some of the growth initiatives that you referred to. Another theme we want to touch on, and that has to do with actually two Chinese companies. Walk us through that.
Yeah. So China is certainly having its challenges. Mm-hmm. I think you all are clearly very well aware of what's going on in the world of Chinese property. It's definitely under pressure on all sorts of different fronts. And there's also other issues. The stock market has fallen and whatnot. There's regulatory measures that are being put in place to try to curtail some of these problems and change the course. Part of those are actually putting a damper on what's going on in the world of initial public offerings and secondary market offerings in the stock market. And CSC Financial is one of China's biggest brokerage firms. And we think that they are due to disappoint through the first half of the year because of this. Another one is a company called Chow Tai Fook. It's based in Hong Kong. It's the biggest Hong Kong-based China jeweler retail company. If you're in Hong Kong, you definitely know Chow Tai Fook. And it's interesting because not only is there a negative effect because of what's going on with property and consumer sentiment on jewelry purchases, but Hong Kongers specifically are going to find things cheaper on the mainland. They're going across the border. And all of this, we think, is driving a disappointing trend for Hong Kong retail sales, and Chow Tai Fook is a poster child for this. So both of those are concerns.
As you said, great illustrations by the Bloomberg Businessweek team. It's all about apples, and these apples are a little bit bruised. So kind of fun to see that go along. We got another sector.
Yeah, I want to talk construction here. Some interesting names from the Bloomberg Intelligence team talking about potential beneficiaries of a construction boom. What did you find, Tim?
Well, so Taylor Morrison is a home builder, and they're ones that focus on larger communities. They've got more and more growth coming from Arizona and Florida. And we think that there's an opportunity to see better margin improvement given the way that they're driving their business, pure and simple. Oshkosh is more on the bigger commercial side, and it's not only construction, but they also do other commercial vehicles like fire trucks or ambulances or the new postal service electric vehicle. So all sorts of projects there. But generally, there's concern that on that commercial side, that there's a down cycle actually that's developing. And we think Oshkosh is going to be able to actually surprise on the positive because they've got such a big backlog and some of these new initiatives that are playing through to the revenue stream.
All right. Finally, a sector we love to talk about, and travel. And you got two names in that. Walk us through those two. Accor is one of them.
Yes. It is. So there's one that's absolutely classic travel, and the other, I'm stretching things a little bit by suggesting travel.
I mean, the Michelin Accor, Guide was created for a reason. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah,
it's just a little preview.
Like there you go.
We're helping you out there.
Yeah. So Accor is a hotel company. And I think a lot of the listeners here have probably stayed at one of their hotels. They go from the very high end to more modest economy brands. The thing that anybody who stayed in a hotel recently has probably found is how expensive it is. You know, it's pretty shocking sometimes what the rates are that you have to pay. That's feeding Accor's revenue. There is a global travel cycle that we think is stronger and longer, and Accor is in the front of that, both from a Europe and an Asian travel base. Interesting, they are French. Their home is in France, and you know it's only a small part of their overall portfolio. But the Paris Olympics this summer are the catalyst we're looking for, because pretty soon we're going to start to see the early bookings that they release in terms of the Paris Olympics, and it should be quite robust. The other one.
20 seconds, though. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. Pirelli. It's a tire company. Mm-hmm. And yes, you have to travel if you get in your car and you spin those tires. they are moving their production bases to Mexico and Romania. It's cheaper. And they're curtailing the low end of their tires to high end. And so there's an upgrade cycle. We think both of those can create positive surprise.
This is not the F1 tire that we're talking about specifically.
It is the F1 Pirelli tire.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Okay.
There
just
you go.
Always love these lists. Names that we know, names that we don't, but definitely you give us the reasons to keep them on our radar. So appreciate it. Tim Tank, thank you so much. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior European Strategist, Director of Research Content, our own Tim Craighead joining us there from London.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Well, the Masters at Augusta currently underway. And so we look at the on-again, off-again drama between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf, involving lots and lots of money, geopolitics, courtroom battles, and even some high-profile trash-talking up on Capitol Hill.
Trash-talking on Capitol Hill?
It can happen.
It can happen. Also from the world of golf, the importance of what golfers call the flat stick and the pursuit of the right putter at almost any price. We've got the brand that is turning a piece of golfing equipment into a $200,000 asset class.
Plus, Michelin's top hotels in France, how decaf became the hottest thing in coffee, and Tim, some great news for us New Yorkers. Our local airports are no longer the worst in the nation.
Come on.
Have you walked through some of them? They're pretty cool.
It's actually one of my favorite things when people come to visit us and they say, LaGuardia is so nice.
It's pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing.
It's a little long walk to get to places, but it's kind of a lovely walk.
It's a nice walk. Yeah, you get to look at planes the whole time.
And I got to say, Newark, which has been, I mean, the target of so much. You know, it's not just about the turnpike, but Newark Airport, everybody makes fun of. But you come off, the first time I came off in Terminal A after it was redone, I was like, where am I?
Okay, I will. It depends on the terminal.
It does. And this
is still renovating.
Well, this is what this story kind of gets into, is this process that it's not all done yet.
Can they do the subways next?
Don't hold your breath. First up this hour, though, she's an Australian cattle dog. She's become a $2 billion smash hit, and now she is facing an existential crossroad. Tim, we're talking about one of your favorite shows. I'm guessing you watch it a lot at home, specifically maybe your kid's favorite show, although I think you probably like it a lot. We're talking about Bluey.
Yeah, I think the thing that people love about Bluey is it's as good for parents as it is for kids. The episodes are so short, so you can tell your kid that they can watch two episodes, and it's like over in 15 minutes. I mean, what's not to love about Bluey?
I gotta say, I missed it with my daughter, and I think it's like this generation of kids. This is who they're really watching.
You know what? When she gets back from college, you guys can watch a few episodes together.
All right, I'm gonna put it on our to-do list.
Well, if you're a parent of kids of a certain age, then the TV show Bluey needs no introduction.
Like Tim.
Yeah, you've probably seen it. You probably love it. And you're more than happy to pay Disney Plus each month to keep those episodes streaming. As Devin Leonard writes for Bloomberg Businessweek, it's, quote, a show that's both hilarious and deeply moving in its portrayal of how children come to terms with the world by playing games and how parents can foster this by joining the fun no matter how wacky it becomes. Devin Leonard is a Bloomberg Businessweek senior global business writer. His story, the cover of the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, it's available on newsstands, on the Bloomberg, and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Devin, I can't tell you how delighted I was to see that Bluey got the cover treatment
from Bloomberg Businessweek. I can tell you, he was like off the charts.
When I heard this was happening, I was like, I cannot wait to do this. But give us an idea of how this story came together.
You know something, Ray Hermance, who's one of the editors, she asked me to do it while I was in the midst of some piece about Sean Diddy Combs and his, you know, his demise, and you know, it's kind of like, you know, I was just like, yeah, sure, because I like to take assignments. I'd never heard of the show, I'd never watched the show, and frankly, all I knew was that I thought it was a Disney show, which it isn't even a Disney show. It's just a show they licensed, but. I started watching
lucky
it.
Lucky for them.
Yeah, well, not so lucky for them. But I just, you know, I started watching it and really got into it. And then I realized actually the people who were really sort of handling the licensing and the merchandising, well, you know, it was actually BBC Studios, the commercial arm of the BBC. So I started talking to them, and, you know, I was going to go to London. Was I going to go to Brisbane, Australia? Well, I wound up going to Brisbane, Australia, where I also met, along with, you know, some of the top people from BBC Studios, Joe Brum, the show's creator, and also the founders of Luna Studio, who produce it. So it's a whole, you know, kind of amazing thing culminating in a trip, you know, last month.
So, all right, because you know how popular it is, because you watch it a lot. And I think if my daughter was much younger, we would be watching
right.
it.
I'm trying to get my kids to watch them. Hey, you got to check this out.
Well, the funny thing is, it's not just appealing to kids, but talk to us about how popular it is.
Well, it's not just the most streamed kids show in the U.S. last year. It's the second most streamed show, period, after Suits.
Amazing.
And Suits is 9 seasons of episodes that are about, you know, almost like 42 minutes long. I mean, that's the whole thing. You know, you get lots of streaming numbers for, you know, if you have lots of episodes. Bluey has 150 episodes. They're only 7 minutes long, and it's just 3 seasons, and yet, you know, people are watching more Blue, you know, than Friends, than Gilmore Girls, than, you know, NCIS. So, I mean, there's something going on. There's something really crazy with, you know, with the, it's not just kids watching it. You know, it's a lot of other people too.
You know, what's interesting in your piece that I learned so much in the piece. I encourage everybody to read it, even if you've never heard of this show. What I found fascinating was this wasn't something that was set to be a hit from the pilot. I mean, this is not following the formula of the typical kid show by any means. This is not cookie cutter.
Right. Well, no, that's the crazy thing. You have this guy, you know, Joe Brum. He's 46 years old. He lives in Brisbane. You know, that's where he went to high school. He spent some time in London as an animator. You know, worked on some shows on the BBC. He came back to, you know, Australia, had a sort of a little animation company that he was running for a while out of his house. And he kind of missed, you know, being around a big crew. So he was sort of like, well, if I'm going to have that again, I need to create a show, my own show, because that's probably the only way it's going to happen. So it's like, well, what's that show going to be? And he liked Peppa Pig. But he was like, you know, I couldn't, you couldn't rip off Peppa Pig, that's like Peppa Pig's family are pigs, and all the other families are other species. So he's like, okay, so I'll make a show about dogs. My family will be Australian Blue Heelers, and their families will be Dachshunds and Basset Hounds and all this stuff. So then he's home. He has two kids, who it turns out are the same age as Bluey and Bingo, or about the same ages. Bluey and Bingo are now, they've actually gotten older on the show. Bluey's 7 and Bingo's 5. They started out at 6 and 4. But so he was able to draw on his own experiences because he's home with them, and he's trying to work and he's running up and down the stairs. And anybody who's watched the show, that's what's going on, with Bandit, the show's father. And Bandit, by the way, is an archaeologist, sort of a, not a stay-at-home, but almost a stay-at-home archaeologist, which is kind of interesting. But in any case, he put together a pilot. The pilot, it had Bandit taking Bluey to the playground. Bandit's playing, Fruit Ninja on his phone. He pushes Bluey around the swing set. Bluey goes around the swing set, clunks him. He shows it to these guys at Ludo Studio, who he'd done some work for, and they liked it. And it was supposed to be from the start. He wanted to do a show that's kind of both for grown-ups and for kids, with two levels of kind of humor. But anyway, the Ludo's guys liked it. They tried to shop it around, and people said to them, "Hey, is this Family Guy or is this Peppa Pig?" And they were kind of like both. And people just didn't get it, except for one guy, Michael Carrington, who was head of children's at the ABC, in this case, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. But it's just, just the genesis of the show is so strange because really it was just Joe Brum, missing being around a lot of other animators.
First of all, I've always adored you, and I love your reporting and respect it. But to hear you talk about Bluey in such detail, it just takes it to a whole other level.
Nice difference from talking about Diddy, Diddy faces.
I'm like trying to think. Well, wait, the last time we talked with you, which is what makes you so wonderful, Devin Leonard.
It's just such, this material is just as rich, and it's kind of crazy.
Well, speaking of rich, right? It's made a lot of money for some people.
Yeah, I mean, it's.
Or who?
It turns out the ABC basically, you might say that they really sort of discovered the show, and Michael Carrington was able to get the ABC to put some money into a pilot. He said I would have greenlit it, on the spot, but they didn't have enough money. So, but they did give Joe Brum and Ludo's enough money to actually make a 5-minute pilot. Which BBC Studios loved, but as part of the deal, BBC Studios wound up with the international distribution and licensing rights. And the ABC guy's like, well, we don't have those kind of resources, so they might as well take that. So then they're the guys that have been making all the money. Ludo Studios controls it, so mm-hmm. obviously they're making money. Joe gets a percentage of the revenues, but they're the people doing all the toy deals, and all that. Yeah.
Well, what about Disney?
Well,
because people watch it in most of the world.
Yeah. No. I mean, I think I said before I came into this whole thing, this is a Disney show. It's just a show they license. And in 2019, they outbid a whole lot of other, including Nickelodeon, for the rights to distribute the show, i.e., on their platforms, on Disney Junior, Disney Channel, and on Disney Plus. But what they passed up at the time, they also had the chance to license the merchandising and the theme park rights,
which
and
they understand.
That's a yeah. But cool. but so that's that's something they really regret now. Because anyway,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay.
We've only got about a minute left.
Season 4. Is there going to be a season 4?
He's asking for his kids.
it hasn't been announced, and season 3 is about to culminate with a special episode. The Sign is 28 minutes long, and people are sort of saying, there's going to be a season 4, but nobody can say for sure. Everyone's trying to act as if there's going to be one, but season 3 was greenlit in 2020. I mean, that's been running in Australia since 2021.
Wow.
So basically, they wrapped season 3, sometime in like 2022, maybe late 2023. So there's nothing else out there, and this is when when, you know, the excitement about the show, it's just, you know, it just keeps getting higher and higher. You know, people are really excited about the time. But then what? And also, what's Bluey worth? I didn't mention it before, but you know, Bluey's been valued, as said to be worth as much as $2 billion. It could be worth, going forward, it could be worth as much as Peppa Pig was and was sold to Hasbro.
Yeah.
For $4 billion. But with three seasons, I don't know. And it's just unclear, Joe Brum, who's really a creative genius, whether or not, he wants to keep going.
Our thanks to Devin Leonard, Bloomberg Businessweek senior global business writer. His story, once again, the cover of the new issue of Businessweek magazine, which is available on newsstands, on the Bloomberg terminal, and at Bloomberg.com/Businessweek. I took four copies of the magazine and gave it to my son's teacher, and they're going to do a project with him.
Oh, that is so great. Oh, my God. See, Businessweek, it appeals to everybody.
Yeah, pre-K kids like Businessweek.
Absolutely.
Can't get them started too young.
I agree. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Coming up, the right putter on the golf course and the big drama off the course, how the mounting tension between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf is leaving everyone rich, but no one happy.
And later on, something in the golf world that's made in small batches and sells for many times what the off-the-rack models do. Circle tees.
Originally, these were clubs that only went out to players on the PGA Tour, players that were playing professionally. And so they really were, custom clubs that are only made for the best players in the world. Now, obviously, Scotty Cameron and his employees are making putters for pros, but they have a stock that is released to the public that, is very similar to the things the pros are getting.
It's all ahead. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, Tim, last week we talked about this a lot. It was one of the most read stories on the Bloomberg. It was about billionaire New York Mets owner Steve Cohen saying he expects that more businesses will move to a four-day work week once AI, artificial intelligence, takes over. And that is one of the reasons he's been pouring millions into...
golf.
Yes.
I was going to say frisbee golf.
Don't.
No.
Wrong.
Golf, real golf.
That would be wrong.
The international game has recently attracted a lot of headlines, with billions being spent on the sport, a battle for supremacy with big names switching from the PGA Tour to upstart LIV Golf, a potential link up between the two, and a framework agreement that has yet to be consummated.
We talk about this a lot, relationships. It's complicated. Well, throw in geopolitics, courtroom battles, trash talking on Capitol Hill, and we have a combustible mix that can go sideways real quick. Mulligan, anyone?
And also with the Masters underway in Augusta, Georgia this weekend, the spotlight is back on the two major rivals turned frenemies with implications that can shake up the future of the sport. This story by Bloomberg Businessweek freelance writer Alan Shipnuck was also a Bloomberg Big Take. He's got more on the pro golf drama where everyone is rich, but no one is happy.
There's been elements of this throughout in my reporting. I mean, there's cloak and dagger stuff with sources reading me documents and letters over the phone, and everyone's been super uptight all the way through because the Department of Justice has been sniffing around. There was his and her lawsuits where the tour and LIV, where they were suing each other, now dismissed. But it's been an incredibly messy, chaotic period for the sport. I've said this before, it's a gift from the content gods. I mean, golf, as we know, is this boring, traditional boutique sport.
Right.
But this battle has gone from the sports page to the business page to the front page because there's so much money at stake. There's so many brand name protagonists. And even whether you're talking about His Excellency Yasir Al-Rumayyan, who runs the PIF, or Donald Trump, who's become part of the story, every golfing great of the last 30 years has been sucked into it. It's really a sprawling, and riveting story to cover.
Right. The PIF being, of course, the Saudi Arabian government's public investment fund. All right. Take us back. Take us back to when LIV first launched. And we were all like, wait, what is this all about? So take us back to kind of the origins and the beginning of this very troubled relationship between the two platforms.
Yeah. I mean, what it's about is money, power, greed, vengeance, you know, legacy. There's these big, huge Shakespearean themes that run through this entire story. On a macro level, I mean, it really comes down to, you know, golf was one of the first sports to go to Saudi Arabia in 2019. The European Tour played an event there, and it was conducted just a few months after Jamal Khashoggi had been murdered. And of course, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has always been implicated in his death. And so the fact that the European Tour stuck by their host, didn't cancel this tournament, even when Western businesses and thought leaders and financial leaders were abandoning the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, that meant a heck of a lot to those in power there. And golf's a global game. It obviously caters to the financial elite. We all know a lot of deals get done on a golf course. And so it served very strategic, goals for Saudi Arabia. And Al Rumayyan, who runs a public investment fund, is a golf tragic. He loves the game as much as anybody. And so the Saudis went all in on golf as a way to sports watch their reputation, as a way to expand their influence, to get into the halls of power, to be get a seat at the proverbial table. There was a lot going on here. And they tried to partner with the European Tour. That didn't work out. They at one point, they were aligned with the Premier Golf League, which was this would-be competitor, upstart league that never quite launched but helped germinate the idea. And ultimately, the powers that be at Saudi Arabia decided to go on and do it on their own. They had the money. They recruited the intellectual capital, a lot of it from the Premier Golf League. And they launched LIV Golf as this incredibly disruptive force, not only in the golf world, right, but really in the entire sports world. And so
what?
And that was 2 years ago, and the reverberations are still being felt.
Well, Alan, and I feel like I'm a daughter of someone who was, my dad was an avid golfer. My four brothers, it was a passage, rite of passage, if you will, in terms of learning golf growing up. And, you know, I grew up kind of watching it. There's a gentility around the sport, to be quite fair, I think.
That's why they won't let me play.
Yeah, you're not supposed to throw your clubs, I'm just going to say. But it's interesting then to see that the animosity between players, well-known players in the sport, certainly American players, that started to arise, of people who you thought were kind of friendly, you know, rivals, if you will, but they really kind of were fighting each other. And there was a lot of money at stake because some players, all of a sudden, some well-known American players, some well-known global players, were all of a sudden being paid and lured away by LIV Golf.
Yeah, the animosity has been delicious. You know, it exists in other sports, right? Like, if you follow NBA Twitter, or, you know, players are always talking trash and there's always beef, and it's part of the narrative of the sport. It's kind of a new arrival for golf, but it's made it more lively for sure. But the PGA Tour enjoyed a monopoly on big time professional golf this whole century, even going a little further back than that. And like any business with no competition, it had gotten stale. It had gotten a little bloated. The product was unimaginative, and it was ripe for disruption. And we know this in any industry, when you have a competitor come in, especially one that's very, very, very well capitalized, it's going to get messy. And the PGA Tour players, it wasn't an existential threat. Like, their livelihood was being threatened because top players immediately defected for LIV, and that weakened the PGA Tour. And if you have a bad product, you're not going to attract a TV audience, you're not going to attract sponsors, and your sport is going to wither. So the tour players, the PGA Tour players, rightfully took it very personally that they were being abandoned and betrayed by their colleagues. Now, basically, it was just free agency came to golf, which exists in every other sport. And, you know, you got a guy right. goes from the Red Sox to the Yankees, and there's some hard feelings, but people understand it's part of the game. But this was a new invention in professional golf. And so, yeah, it became very personal. Then you layer on top of that the fact that this was all being underwritten by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And, you know, if the money had come from Europe or had come from American investors, it would have, the debate would have had a different tenor. But clearly, in the wake of the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, who was a U.S. resident and who was a columnist for The Washington Post, undeniably the fact that 15 of the 19 hijackers of 9/11 were Saudi nationals, it's an emotional issue for a lot of American sports fans and a lot of American citizens. And so to feel like there was this force from the other side of the world that with this shadowy leader in MBS and, you know, not fully understanding the intentions behind it, there's just been a level of discomfort that it's not so, just that the whole sport has been shaken up, but by who's underwriting it. And that's why you've seen congressional hearings. That's so, why you've seen a lot of blowback.
Yeah. So, Alan, how do we get to the point where Liv and the PGA are at loggerheads and they're fighting for talent, lots of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars is flying. How do you get to that point where suddenly they reach this framework, this agreement?
Because they had put them, both tours were kind of on this path to mutually assured destruction. You know, the PGA Tour product was badly devalued. They lost a bunch of their stars and Hall of Famers and biggest personalities. And yet to fight Liv, the tour leadership was going to all their corporate sponsors saying, we need a lot more money. We got to pay the players more. And the sponsors were rebelling and saying, you're asking for more money for a diminished product. Like, that's a tough sell. Simultaneously, these lawsuits were, the legal fees were running in the tens of millions of dollars. And so for the tour, they were running out of money. For Liv Golf, they'd made all this noise and they'd burst onto the scene, but they had antagonized huge swaths of the golfing fans and the golfing public. And they were struggling to attract an audience. And so both, I think there was this moment of inflection, like both organizations had to change course. And so the framework agreement, you know, it was oversold. People called it a merger. It was never that. It was basically an agreement to drop the lawsuits, which obviously helped both sides financially. And then they were going to figure out everything else later. But because it was such a stunner, I mean, this was an all-time thunderbolt in the history of sports business when these two warring factions came together with no warning, all of it done in secret. The impact was so great by that announcement. People expected things to change rapidly, but really, both sides, there was tremendous amount of distance in their vision of what was going to happen. And so they've been at this stalemate for 9 months trying to negotiate this. As it became clear, the framework agreement had no teeth. There was no penalty if either side walked away. You know, the sharks began to circle from Wall Street, from Silicon Valley, and from Hollywood. And the PGA Tour began getting other offers, whether it's private equity money or other origins. Mm-hmm. People said, hey, listen, you want money? We have money too. You don't have to take the Saudi money. And so the pieces began to move on the chessboard. The tour announced in January it had taken $1.5 billion and they have access to another $1.5 billion from the Strategic Sports Group, which is a consortium of American sports team owners and private equity guys and gals. And then Liv, you know, as a preemptive strike, they signed John Rahm, the reigning Masters champion, as kind of a warning shot, like, okay, if you're not going to negotiate with us, if you're going to take this other money, we're going to keep stealing your players. So it went, this cold war is heated up. And now it's increased the pressure on both sides around this negotiation. And there's a lot at stake, money, ego, and legacy. And no one knows where it's going to go. They're still at loggerheads. And there's a lot of momentum to get it done, and there's a lot of reasons why it could fall apart. And so it remains a cliffhanger.
That was Bloomberg Businessweek freelance writer Alan Shipnuck. If his name sounds familiar, it's because he's written a lot of books about the sport of golf. Check out some of those in addition to this great story. You can catch that story in the forthcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's out next week. It's already online, though, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
And staying with golf for a moment, Tiger Woods.
Heard of him.
Yeah. His and other golf greats' putter choice, who knew, how that turned a brand into a lofty asset class.
Plus, the French hotels getting the big-time Michelin nod.
And decaf, long been the subject of derision and jokes within the coffee industry, alas, no more.
These new innovations in their method. For a long time, it was using benzene. Swiss Water in their facilities in British Columbia, they used water. They actually use like a green coffee extract.
Okay.
And they soak the beans, and then the caffeine molecules bind to the extract, and then it's flushed.
So it's safe to drink decaf now?
Yes. It's all ahead in Pursuits. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, Carol, the new issue of Business Week is out, and in it, a story about Scotty Cameron's custom golf clubs that are solid investments. Objects dart, you might even say, that attract a whole other level of devotee.
Just ask Tiger Woods, Brooks Koepka, others. Are they worth the love? Writing about it is freelance contributor Chris Almeida, who joins us now about the putter choice that's turned a brand into an asset class. Chris, who is and what is Scotty Cameron?
So Scotty Cameron is a putter maker based in Southern California who has been making putters since he was a kid. You know, he started tooling around in his garage with his dad when he was a preteen. And he was a competitive golfer as a junior, but, you know, pretty quickly realized that he wasn't going to make it as a pro. And so he decided to go all in on making putters. And when he was in his 20s, an old instructor of his brought in a 12-year-old Tiger Woods to come see the clubs that he'd made. And Tiger, as a little kid, loved them and has more or less played them ever since, which has been part of what has made Scotty Cameron's business so successful. In the mid-90s, he signed a contract to be exclusive with Titleist. And then in 97, Tiger Woods obviously won the Masters with this very distinctive Scotty Cameron putter. It was a black putter with a bunch of white dots in the back and a copper insert in the front. And ever since then, the brand has exploded, and now his custom putters, which are differentiated from the ones that Titleist sells, you know, that are mass manufactured, are extremely expensive and very hard to get. And every golfer wants one. But even if you can afford it, you can't often get your hands on one.
Okay, so talk about the supply and demand part of this here, because this is a company that does essentially drops a limited edition, limited supply of these putters in time increments, and people line up for them, and very few people actually get them.
They've definitely embraced some of the drop culture that has been, you know, made very popular by brands like Supreme. They release four or five custom putters to the public every week via email newsletter, and these will vary in design until Wednesday when this email goes out. You don't know what any of these are going to look like. They could be different colors, have different weird stampings on them. They could have, you know, a different kind of neck or a different kind of putter blade or whatever, and they'll be priced accordingly. And I think around 4 years ago, demand for these rose so high that they would sell out basically within seconds of the email going out. And so they had to institute a lottery system where now when the email goes out, you have to say, I'm interested in buying this putter, and click a button and enter to buy it. And if you get an email back saying you've been chosen to buy it, you get the privilege of spending $4,000 on one of these clubs.
These are the Circle T's, right?
Yes. A Circle T, which is, it's a logo kind of inspired by a branding iron. that is meant to denote, you know, somewhat misleadingly that these clubs are for tour use only. So originally these were clubs that only went out to players on the PGA Tour, players that were playing professionally. And so they really were, you know, custom clubs that are only made for the best players in the world. Now, obviously, Scotty Cameron and his employees are making putters for pros, but they have a stock that is released to the public that, you know, is very similar to the things that the pros are getting.
Speaking of stock or stocks, you get into in the story, you know, goods and items that sell on the secondary market. So the story gets into how this has become an asset class. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So I said how much they cost when you buy them directly from the company. When you buy them not directly from the company, they're going to be at least twice as expensive. So you'll see these, you know, particular putters, depending on what they are, can go for tens of thousands of dollars. And then often, basically, the putters that look just like Tiger Woods's putter can sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars. So there, I talked to Ryan Carey, who runs Golden Age Auctions, which is an auction house that basically sells golf collectibles, and he managed to get his hands on a Tiger Woods backup putter, which is something that Scotty made for Tiger just in case something happened to Tiger's main putter. And this eventually got sold, and then when it was auctioned by Golden Age Auctions, it sold for $400,000. So that is, yeah, you know, that's kind of the top end. I'm not going to pretend like that's regular, but even the ones that are released every week, if something goes for $4,000, you can instantly flip it for $8,000, and the demand will be there, no question.
So I guess the big question that I have is, does the putter really change your game?
Probably not that much.
Huh.
It's hard to say, and this is, I think, part of the mystique or the, you know, romanticism of putters in general, is that, you know, putting is a hard part of the game to measure. Golf clubs in almost every other part of the game, drivers, irons, wedges, you know, the things that those clubs are doing can be measured. The spin rates can be measured. The club path that, you know, particular golfer has can be measured. And then you can design a club to really fit that well. Putting is the least scientific part of the game. And so a lot of what has to do with being a good putter is confidence and repeatability. And so people get a little religious about their putters, but there's just enough of a question for people to maybe believe.
That's freelance contributor Chris Almeida.
All right, everybody, it's time for Bloomberg Pursuits, everything from top, top, top hotels in France to the coffee that gets no love until now. And speaking of not getting love until now, go figure, Tim, New York City airports.
Yeah, they were the butt of jokes, but now they're actually looking pretty good. This is all from our Pursuits team. Joining us is the deputy editor of Bloomberg Pursuits, James Gatti. James, I was telling Carol, one of my favorite things, you know, pastimes, I guess, is when people come to visit in New York, they say, LaGuardia is really nice now.
It's so true.
People tweet about it all the time. It's because it's like such a different. I was in LaGuardia once and there were buckets all over collecting rainwater.
It's not, you know, funny. It was terrible.
You know, we have a quote from Rick Cotton, the executive director of the Port Authority, who's like, people are telling me they are actually going to LaGuardia early just so they can hang out. That's me. Like, that's JFK me is so much closer to me. I'm actually buying tickets to fly out of LaGuardia.
Because you want to hang, right? It's so nice.
That water feature is really,
yeah, it's really nice.
It's always crowded. I can't get a seat next to
kids
it.
Kids love it. You walk past the life-size Lego person to get to it.
Yes, yes. Are you posting pictures on Instagram?
No. Okay, so no. How did we get here, though? How did we get here?
A lot of billions of dollars.
Public-private partnerships?
Yeah. LaGuardia got $8 billion, to be exact. Honestly, if you want to go back a little bit, it starts with our president, Joe Biden.
I remember this.
Who, in 2016, when he was vice president, landed in LaGuardia and said it reminded him of a third world country. And, you know, it was sort of like, I mean, it was a little tactless, of course. But, you know, I don't know how much that sort of like kickstarted everything. But yes, $9 billion later, last month, it was named best airport in the United States. 5 years ago, it was literally the last one on the list, the worst.
as a New Jersey person, born mm-hmm. and bred, proud of it, Jersey girl. Newark, the first time I came off Terminal A after its renovation, I was like, where am I? Like, when and when did this happen?
That one took a little bit longer. It was 5 years in the making. $2.7 billion goes a little bit further in New Jersey, I guess, you might expect.
It's amazing when you cross the river.
But I have to say, I'm really excited about JFK. It's $19
billion. Yeah, why are you so excited about JFK?
It's huge. It's terrible. And, you know, it just, they're just old. They've been kind of taking their hits. And, you know, one of the interesting things that we talked to the design firm, Gensler, who is doing JFK, they said everything we made, every decision we're making is for the customer in mind. And that extends to accessibility. First airport, he said, he's ever worked on where accessibility has been first and foremost in their mind.
I asked Carol, can they do the subways next?
Yes, I just got off the subway and I was thinking that exact same thing.
Please help
speaking
us.
Speaking my language down.
But I like the way they're rethinking the space. I have to say, I'm one of those people who really likes a good airport. I just do. I wander. I like. It's like shopping. It's like just. It's an experience, right? And that's how they're thinking about it.
Not speaking my language.
Okay. I know what does speak your language, Carol.
Well, we're going.
And that's coffee.
We're going from something that wasn't loved, the New York City area airports, to also something that wasn't loved, decaf coffee. Because I am a big decaf coffee drinker, and
no
people.
Way.
I know. Please don't judge me.
Well, she's part of the. That's exactly what's happening with why more people are drinking decaf now.
Yeah.
So tell me what's going on.
Artisanal coffee. I mean, you know, you think of like the blue bottle coffees of the world, and they take their coffee seriously. And you could argue if they take the caffeine version of their coffee seriously, they're going to take the decaf version seriously. So that's one of it, one part of it. The other part is, you know, these new innovations in their method. For a long time, it was using benzene.
Yeah, what's up with that? Tim and I are both like, holy, out of
I had
everything.
No idea until I read
like,
this.
We like, read the story, we're like, benzene?
Yeah. Carcinogens were used for years to remove the caffeine from coffee beans.
Yeah. So I think that might have been part of the problem with the taste.
Can we confirm that these methods are no longer used? Are they just using water now?
Swiss water in their facilities in British Columbia, they use water. They actually use like a green coffee extract and they soak the beans and then the caffeine molecules bind to the extract and then it's flushed.
So it's safe to drink
decaf
to drink.
Now? Yes, it's very safe.
Are you sure?
Yes, but, positive, 100%.
But I think what was such a big deal about this story is that from a taste perspective, there was a recent competition and for the first time in years, a decaf coffee won the taste test.
Yeah, the Brewer's Cup last month.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, you know, that in bean in particular uses a little bit of a different method than what Swiss Water uses. They use ethyl acetate. I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but you basically ferment molasses and you convert it into all this other stuff. Then they blend it with the mucilage or the pulp, which gives it actually more flavor back into the bean.
No benzene, though.
No benzene.
All right, we've run out of time, but there's a great thing. We highly recommend everybody go online or check out the magazine because Michelin Now, right, doing its first ever ranking of top hotels, and they start with Paris.
Yeah, you know, 3-star Michelin restaurant. Now you got 3 key Michelin hotels. They started in Paris. There's 189 of them. The whole list is on our website.
This is why we love you guys. All the things to do. Thank you for bringing back decaf.
And a big thank you to Deputy Editor of Bloomberg Pursuits, James Gatti.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.